We're running a little over 2 minutes, 3 minutes now. My name is Clancy. My name is Clancy Imeslund, and I'm an alcoholic. You've got these mics so screwed up, nobody sounds right on them. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I want to thank Precious Patty for that charming introduction and for she and the committee for inviting me to come here. It's a pleasure to come here. This week, as some of you know, I've been in Florida, just a few miles north of Acapulco, at a place called Iztapa Zihuatanejo. And they had an AA thing that some people in our group set up there. 500 AAs took over a Club Med. And we sit on the beach and in the hot sun, and every once in a while go and swim in the warm ocean. And then they had the speaker coming over, the loudspeaker, so you didn't actually have to go to the meeting if you didn't feel like. And I'll tell you about Wednesday, I got so restless that, oh, this is all very nice, but I want to get to Chicago. I wanted to see how dumb you were. But I stopped off last night and saw my wife briefly, and I said, do you want to come with me to Chicago? She says, no, it's so nice around here when you're traveling. Next month we'll celebrate 45 years of marriage for her, about 23 for me. But I am glad to be here tonight to see a lot of old friends and a lot of new friends, and glad to see some of the rogues here from Lamont Oaks, and Dick from Nebraska, and some of the boys from Nebraska, and from hither and yon, and Don from Florida. I want to thank Chris and Lori and Don, who came to the airport today to meet me. And you know me, I never criticize. If you can't say anything good, I don't say anything. We couldn't remember what floor we left our car on. So we just spent all just out in the cold area. I believe it's on this floor. Maybe the next one.
Oh, take your time, son. I don't care. You know.
And then we got in, and Don, I don't know if you know Don, who used to live in Chicago, now lives in Florida, drove on the way back, and that brings you a little closer to Jesus than you ever were, I'll tell you. In front of the newcomers, I didn't want to look frightened, but so nobody knew I was frightened. No one will ever know except my laundryman. But anyway, we've all here. I think this is an outstanding turnout for a first-time convention. Usually I get 200 or 300, and they look dissatisfied, and got a large group here. Some boob come all the way from Philadelphia. Nothing personal. He's big and strong. Nice to have you here, son. But it's a nice feeling. And we're talking about good subjects. I looked over the program when I got here today, and there's other subjects I like. The history of AA and the traditions of AA and the steps of AA and the spiritual concepts of AA. And we sometimes have a tendency to take so much for this for granted that we forget. After you're sober a while, it becomes just kind of old hat. And then we forget what a series of tremendous, unusual, miraculous coincidences had to take place to get Roland deciding to go to the Oxford movement, then deciding to go to Vermont just in time to save Ebby from going to prison so he could go back to New York, and just in time to save Bill Wilson, who could meet Dr. Bob just in time to keep his sobriety. So, and on and on and on. Just a series of funny little coincidences that have built up over the years. And eventually to write this book, which is a miracle. You know, we as is often said, I have a tendency, I get a little jaded sometimes in AA. I'm sure you do too. Maybe you don't. But hearing people talk about miracles, their idea of what a miracle is and mine is something unusual. I mean, they say things like, I got up this morning. I looked at the eastern sky, and the sun was coming up into a golden morning. I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day. And I think, oh, Jesus, you know. Get up early tomorrow, you'll see another one, you boob, you know. Miracles have to be things that are inexplicable. And this book is an inexplicable miracle. I remember when I first read it, when I first got sober briefly, and I had a sponsor who was some kind of fanatic, and he wanted me to read that book. And I read it, and you know, it's kind of a joke at AA. They say things like,
when I came to AA, I read that book, and I thought it was very poorly written.
I've been a writer most of my adult life. I've made my life livelihood writing, much of my life. And I didn't think it was a badly written book. It's not a badly written book. It has it seems to people like me, it has even worse fault. It is just a dull, dull book. You just read it till you just go to sleep reading that crap. And so I never paid much attention to it. Some years later, when I came back to AA from Skid Row, and my front teeth kicked out and my family gone, a new sponsor, a fanatic, had me read that book. And you know what I discovered this time? I discovered that book was really dull. You read it. If we're thorough at this stage of your development, you will find. So I kind of had to give up on the book. But I had a vicious sponsor who made me do things that, in his weird thinking, would help me, and they did help me, and later on I found them all in the book. And as I got sober a little while and got some. It gets smarter every year you're sober. It's the only, you know, there's a lot of millions of books that are written on self-help and, you know, I'm okay, you're okay. Last year committed suicide. Not his fault. Turned out he came from a dysfunctional family. I came from a dysfunctional family. I realized later I was the one that made it dysfunctional. But anyway. I don't want to get off on that subject because we don't judge here at all, but I have never met anyone who did not come from a just dysfunctional family. If there's anyone here who did not come from a dysfunctional family, if you'll see me after the meeting, I'll give you a nickel. Maybe I'll give you the rights to the South Lobby. But this book gets smarter and smarter as you stay sober. I'll tell you, you read things in there. To this day, once a year, I read a month at a book study meeting in our group. Every Tuesday night, I read. And I still read stuff that I never saw there before. I mean, because when you read out loud, you can't skim. When you read, you skim, you know. Just your eyes just skim. When you read out loud, you got to read every word and every sentence. And God, that book gets smarter and smarter. You think, how could that guy do it? And the miracle of it is, he did not know enough to write the book. I'll tell you that. For 4,000 years, the leading people, doctors, medical people, religious people, have been working on this problem of people who have this unnatural reaction to alcohol. And nobody could understand it, and they couldn't find any reason for it. And once upon a time, there was a group called the Washingtonians that kept 500,000 people sober, but they didn't know what they were about, and finally they were extinct, and they all got drunk again. And it was a dreadful thing in the 1840s. And here's a guy sat down with no background in psychology, no background in alcoholism. Most of the people he was trying to help were drunk again. It's hard to remember that. There's a little foreword in that book that says, we are of a group of over 100 men and women who have stayed sober a year. He later wrote that there were only 79, actually. but he thought 100 would have a nice ring to it. We all understand that. Now, and he wrote this book without any background information, and it's, you know, no big deal. And that book that he wrote, that he didn't really know enough to write, the miracle of it, not that he wrote the book, because there's all kinds of books, but the miracle is that that book in the last 54 years since it's been published has changed more alcoholic lives than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now that is what you call a miracle. That is a miracle. And nothing has ever come anywhere near to approaching its effectiveness. He wrote about stuff that he said, this is what will happen to you. For example, in the 12 Promises. He wrote about stuff that hadn't happened to him yet. You read a self-help book, they're always full of things that are going to happen to you. You know they won't, but they sound good. Reading self-help books is very similar to peeing your pants on a street corner. It has no lasting value, but it makes you feel warm while you do it. You know, just till the next cold wind blows, and there you are. I can tell you that from personal experience. But all self-help books say these will happen to you, and Bill Wilson wrote the same things. Here's what will happen to you. All these things will happen. Most of them hadn't happened to him. Most of the things he was talking about, he was in the middle of. He was in terrible financial insecurity and with a lot of fear of insecurity. He wasn't instinctively handling things that used to baffle him. His best friend his right-hand man in AA, more than Dr. Bob, a guy named Hank B., had just gotten drunk because he was mad at Bill and was traveling around to the AA group saying, let's keep the money and AA away from Bill Wilson because he's a liar and a cheat and a thief. And those were groups, the Chicago group, for example, the Chicago groups in the 1940, 41, 42, in the 1940s, had very little to do with Bill Wilson. They sent two guys a month to Akron, because Akron was in competition with New York. It was a terrible time. And he wrote this book, and these 12 promises. Now, what's odd of the miracle is that if you've been sober a while, you've noticed they do come true. How would he know they would come true? Just some more promises. They've all come true in my life, and they go away again because I'm a human being and I screw them up. I remember the first time I was about five years sober, and my family rejoined me after being separated for many years. And they moved to California. And it was really a culture shock because I'd been living alone and had a little apartment, and all of a sudden I had all my kids back and my wife, and they needed money, and it just couldn't get any sympathy anywhere because I'd made a big thing for years of saying, well, my family's gone, but I'm bravely living alone, and I'll be all right. I said, oh, you wonderful guy. And here they all came back, and Jesus, kids roaming everywhere, you never could get in the bathroom, dogs barking, biting, just wife crying, and try to go to a meeting, get some sympathy. They said, well, you must be very happy now. You've got your family back. I remember calling up my sponsor and saying, Chuck, they said financial insecurity would leave you. God, I'm sober about 6 years, and I can hardly stand. I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent. That's what the hell am I going to do? That promise is not true. He said, son, it doesn't say that. It says fear of financial insecurity will leave you. God, what an answer. But little by that book changed these lives. And incorporated in that book, of course, was the 12 Steps, which really was a hang-up to Bill. He wrote in his later years that he had some thoughts from the Oxford group, and they were still in the Oxford group when he wrote this book. There were some things in the Oxford group that he instinctively knew would be terrible for alcoholics, and there were things that would be good for alcoholics. Among the things he thought were bad were, for example, like the Oxford group was really aggressively evangelical. They would grab people by the lapel and tell them about things, and they were always grinding. He said, alcoholics don't respond well to that. So he didn't want to put that in. And they were very, very public about their personalities. They got one part of the Oxford Group movement was to get your name in the paper and get people cognizant of what you're doing. And he knew this wasn't good for alcoholics. And probably one of the worst things that he felt alcoholics could do was to adopt the concept of the four absolutes of the Oxford movement. Some of you may not be familiar with them, but the cornerstone of the Oxford movement was absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And there's nothing really wrong with that. And in fact, until the 1970s and well into the 80s, many of the groups in the Akron area kept those on the wall. And some of the groups germane to the Akron groups. But Bill Wilson had the feeling, we were talking about before the meeting, and I believe it's absolutely true. One of the great problems with alcoholics is that they are absolutists by nature. Interesting sidelight. In the 1950s, Yale University, when alcoholism began to have some cachet as a socially acceptable illness for some, they did a masterly investigation of alcoholics. They had all kinds of tests. They brought in the Yale Institute of Alcoholic Studies, brought in all kinds of tests. They had a group of known alcoholics. They had a group of known non-alcoholics. And they'd give them all the tests to see what the difference was. And, you know, they'd give them things like, how would you respond differently after, say, three drinks? So they'd give the non-alcoholics three drinks and test them again. They'd give the alcoholics a test, give them three drinks and test them again. I've often thought, wouldn't you want to be there for that part of the test? Well, that's all the drinks for today. Bullshit, Jack. You know. But this went on for a long time. And they finally got a report this thick. And it was a masterpiece of the report. But they had very little luck in finding out anything that made alcoholics alcoholics. Because they seemed to come from different psychological backgrounds, different economic backgrounds, different racial backgrounds, different ethnological backgrounds. Everything's different. In effect, they only really found two things that seemed to be pretty well common to all the known alcoholics they tested. They all, for some reason they could not understand, on their psychological profiles, ranked in the top percentiles in perfectionism. Now, I don't understand that, because I am not a perfectionist. I want things to be right, and if they're not, screw it. And the other thing that they were high in, they seemed to have some change in their psychological profile after they drank. And nobody could understand that. They don't know why. But the tests after drinking seemed to show a different personality than the tests before drinking. Nobody could understand that. And that kind of took it by surprise. And it really shouldn't take it by surprise. Just a sidelight, because I'm in Illinois tonight. You know, the Washingtonian movement started in 1840 and was the most successful therapy for alcoholism ever until maybe 1950, when we had enough members as they had in 5 years. But they, by the time of their second anniversary of their founding, they had maybe 200,000 members all over the country. And they had members all over Illinois. In fact, if you go through, it's an interesting thing. The Springfield chapter of the Washingtonians celebrated the second anniversary by having one of the local citizens come over and address them on the subject of their drinking. He knew nothing about drinking except what he'd seen in them. But they had this young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln come over and talk to them. And if you ever look through a book of Lincoln's speeches, you find the talk he gave. And it's really fantastic because he really understood alcoholism. He said, I don't know why it is, but when you people drink, you seem to have a different feeling than I have when I drink. And I don't know what it is, and you don't know what it is. But that's the whole thing. If I had the feeling you got after drinking, I suppose I would drink too. And that really is the name of the game. But nobody understood that. But this concept of perfectionism, which has always been for people like me, and I presume like most of you, that's what's wrong with the four absolutes. And he decided we had to find goals to aim toward them, but not to insist on finding them, because none of us could ever measure up and we'd always eventually fail and quit, because we always do that when we're trying to be perfect. So little by little, he's having a difficulty. Remember, he wrote later, how can he put down these things that he wants to put in there? And he was lying there, and he seemed like he had a dream or something. And he suddenly jumped up and went over and wrote out the 12 steps. He'd had them in mind, but they solidified in his mind. He wrote these 12 steps. And they've been there ever since. And they were put into the book. The only difference is, as most of you know, that when he got all done with writing this book, he mimeographed a number of copies and sent them around to people to check and see if he was right. He sent them to some doctors and some health people and to members of the fellowship and all over. And it's an interesting thing. Some of you have seen or heard that original manuscript, how the 12 steps read. They read, you must do this. You will do that. You will take the on your knees, and so on. And of all things, a doctor in New Jersey that was not an alcoholic, didn't know nothing about alcoholism, wrote back and said, I would suggest that you do not say you do this, because it's been my experience, alcoholics do not respond to that sort of thing. You have to make it more encompassing so they understand that they feel the way you feel. And so we went in and changed all the steps to read, here's what we did this, and we did that, and changed a few other parts of the book. Then the book was published, and the steps have been firm ever since, except for one step. Since the first, if you ever see a first edition of the big book, can't you wait till you get in the car? Christ's sake. Jesus. Yeah. I don't know why I said. Take that off the tape there, Rosemary. But when the book came out, the AAs at that time came up to Bill Wilson in New York and said, this is wrong, Bill. The 12 step, these steps are all very nice, but what you've written in there is 12. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. That's not correct. We haven't had any spiritual experience. You're the only one who's ever had a spiritual experience. And you had it in Towns Hospital in 1935, long before you met us, long before you're doing any of this stuff. So that isn't right. You didn't have a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. That's wrong. You had it separately. And when do we get ours? And that was really correct. And they really had to do a lot of thinking about that. Fortunately, the book sold extremely slowly. So they had a lot of time to think about it. And finally, they kind of came to the conclusion. I think Bill had it glimmering. I don't think he really understood it then, but he did later. But do you remember the story of Roland Hazard, the guy I talk about in our group who went to Dr. Jung in Switzerland, and Dr. Jung had told him it had been his experience that the only alcoholics who ever stayed sober were people who had had a spiritual experience, and they were one in a million, maybe one in 5 million, maybe one in 10 million. And of all those early AAs, Bill Wilson was the only one who had a spiritual experience, and yet these people were staying sober. And how did they explain that? How can you have a spiritual experience? And to this day, if you look around you, millions of people in AA, and in my life, I've only known two people that I truly believe had the type of spiritual experience they're talking about. Now, how can you explain that? They started to get a glimmering that what's going on here is something unprecedented in the treatment of these kind of people. And that is this, somehow, in some way that nobody can understand, when you do these things, you bring about a gradual spiritual experience. You bring about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson had his in Towns Hospital, boom, but the way you and I have ours, little by little.
Make amends to that bitch?
And all the little things we must do. And little by little, it brings about a spiritual change without the whoom. And so that's why in the next printing of the book, and ever since then, the 12th step has been changed. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Not a spiritual experience, but a spiritual awakening. And so now we have the 12 steps that we talk about. We put them on big signs. If you're fortunate, you will be in a group where they insist you do them. If you're lucky, you will have a sponsor who will not permit you to slack up, who will not think that love consists of letting you gradually die because he doesn't want to hurt your feelings by having you do things you don't agree with. And so today the 12 steps are a snap. A is a snap. Dr. Jung said that alcoholics die or go insane if they're not kept confined. But we know that's not true. So today it really should be not necessary for any alcoholic to go crazy or die from alcoholism or any of these things. We got a way out. It's right there. It's by helping people around you. So you and I in America, which is certainly the heartbeat of AA, there's in 128 countries or something, but it's certainly it's right here in America, and you and I are very fortunate. You and I probably will never know anybody who dies of alcoholism, maybe. There's only one small cloud, and that's this. It is estimated today in America where there is more alcoholic recovery. There's more alcoholic recovery in this room than there was in the world after 10 years of AA's experience, or 20 years perhaps. And here's the big deal. Today, with all the help, AA, if you can't bring yourself to go to AA right away, there's all kinds of treatment centers who will adjust their schedules for you to come there. Some of them who will tell you that not only will they cure alcoholism, but alcoholism is just one. All these things are one disease. Addiction, alcoholism, overeating, gambling, it's all one disease. The people who say that was started by a treatment center that only owned one van. But in America, where alcoholism is so easily overcome, it is estimated now that about 95% of alcoholics in America still die drunk. Isn't that staggering? And that's today. That's with all the help available. I think it's safe to say that a number of people in this room will die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. Maybe me and maybe you, but you can say that safely about any large group of alcoholics. Because it isn't how we feel tonight or how good we feel. It's something else that some divine force had Bill put in that book. That somewhere up ahead, we will be tested on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And they don't announce the day of the examination. So you got to kind of keep a little. That doesn't mean that you have to stay in some sort of monk-like position, kneeling, praying incessantly 24 hours a day. The spiritual maintenance is done by continuing to at least some degree, practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and to make sure that you stay active in attending meetings and being of service to others. That is the spiritual maintenance. It is not some hokey-pokey, weird back porch religion. It's the principles they talk about. Now, why would there be so many people dying of alcoholism? for the same reason that you and I almost did and may do it yet if we turn off our heads. Because down deep in my heart and down deep in your heart, when I feel bad, I get the same message in different forms. I don't think I'm really an alcoholic. Not really. Not like they are. Their problem is drinking. And they stop drinking and shape up and their lives get better. I have problems much more complex than that and much sadder, and I feel worse. And I drink. When I drank, it was to help the problems, help me get rid of the problems. I'm not an alcoholic. I feel things too intensely. Maybe I'm too insensitive. Maybe I'm neurotic. Maybe I'm too sensitive to things. Maybe I feel things too strongly. Maybe I'm not quite good enough like I always think. But I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because that's what makes me feel whole. And sometimes I drink too much. And then well-intentioned people say to me things like, oh, you've got a drinking problem. But I know I don't. Not really. I remember thinking years ago, it's very easy to stop me and give me a citation for drunken driving. It's too bad you don't have a balloon I can blow up to measure my level of fear today, because that's what made me drink. It's too bad you can't take a drop of blood out of my ear like you do for this goddamn drunken driver test and measure how different I feel and how I feel ill at ease. It's too bad that you don't have a white line for me to walk to determine how lonely I am and how much I really need someone to just give me a pat on the back, even though I pretend I don't want it. But all you can do is measure what happens when I drink too much as a response to that. I'm not really an alcoholic. These kind of things are nice for people whose problem is alcohol. My problem is something that I and my psychiatrist and everybody I know can't find out, but I feel it every day of my life. And that's how I felt in 1949 when I was sent to my first AA meeting. And I was a young guy, I got my first drink in Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War. I was 15, just before my 16th birthday. About as far before my 16th birthday as Patty's party was, 2 days before my 16th birthday. Where I live, we celebrate our birthdays on our birthday. But you do it any way you want, honey. I haven't been reimbursed for my plane ticket yet. You know, it isn't a bad idea having a little bit early, now that I think about it. And by the time I was 22 years old, I was acting bizarre enough to be sent to an AA. To a bunch of... 22 is not terribly young in AA today, but then known in that area, no one heard of it within 15 years of it. A bunch of old pasty-faced guys around 40, 45, old burned-out pukes.
Wish I were 45 again.
Yeah. But,
come here and you work those steps and you get better.
And you look at those steps and it's enough to gag a maggot. I mean, they're nice, but if you're a Lutheran, you know that you've already had something better than that. And they're nice. Well, you're going to come to an AA and you're going to get all better. And it didn't. And I went out again and I came back to AA intermittently over the next few years. Came to AA drunk. I remember being thrown down the steps at the Logan Square group one time just to hurt me.
Get that little shit out of here, Fred. Okay. Love is the answer.
Expelled from the YMCA on South, what is that street down there? Wabash, 1100 South Wabash. Series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. It's a cold town, I'll tell you. But every town is a cold town to me, so it's all right. But that's why I like to say now, I try to say this whenever I talk, because I know there's a lot of young people here. And I don't think they tell you, I mean, you forget sometimes that how different. When I was a young guy, 22 was too young to be an age. Now 22 is good. And I want to say, in my home group in Los Angeles, some of you have been there. A couple of you have been members of it. We have about 10 or 1,100 people that meet every Wednesday night in this big synagogue. And it's a, we have a lot of young people. And if you young guys and girls here tonight are like the young people in our group, I want to tell you something. You are the AA leaders of tomorrow. You think that's funny? And I'll tell you something else. If you're like the young people in our group, I am really glad I'm going to be dead. Like this. Nothing personal. I just, you know, just my sponsor told me that 30 years ago, and he's glad he's dead. But anyway, I went to AA off and on, and I went to therapy. I went to psychotherapy. I got into metaphysics. I read books. I got somewhat successful sometimes because I always had a great ambition that overrode my craziness sometimes, but it always disappeared. And when I wound up being thrown out of a skid row mission years later, everything I had gone, home, family, career, my front teeth. Yeah. You can get new families and homes, but like our book says, we're like men who have lost their front teeth. We never grow new ones. And I'll tell you, I went to AA one more time, and it's the same old stuff, same old book, same old non-applicable steps. And these steps are, I just want to talk a little bit about them, because if you're new or having difficulties, you can see that they're not really much. You're going to come here and admit that you drank too much and therefore your life is all screwed up. And then you're going to admit you're crazy and God's going to somehow make this all right. You're going to return to God and God's going to make you feel wonderful. Then you're going to turn all your problems over to God. Try that some morning when you can't pay your rent. You know, here, God. Going to write down things you wouldn't tell your psychiatrist and tell them to some blabbermouth. Did you know I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? They're going to ask God to make you perfect so you can be like all the people, get rid of all your defects, so you can be like all the people you've secretly hated, so you can get your own little set of thin blue lips and go, I don't believe I'd care to do that. That seems to be fun. I don't want to be like that. Then you're going to make here's the funny part. You're hanging on the cross. They want you to get off and make amends to the people who put you there. Sorry. Sorry, here's $20 for calling the police on me that time. Hope it wasn't an inconvenience for you, you son of a bitch. Now you're going to continue to take inventory in case there's anything that's healed over. Keep digging till you find it.
Oh, I almost forgot you, didn't I?
Then meditation. That's a great step for guys like me. I was put in the Texas Insane Asylum as a successful suicide that had been caught and revived. And that suicide came because I spent a little too much time thinking. And that's all I need is a meditation step. I just put me in a closet by myself and bring my pistol in about a half an hour. To improve my conscious contact with a God who has been trying to get me since I was 11 years old. Oh, there he is now. Whoppa! I don't know how it is in other places, but the Norwegian Lutheran God does not suffer fools graciously, I'll tell you. Then you're going to show your gratitude how? By driving across town in the middle of the night, trying to tell this to some fool that's puking on your shoes, you know. The steps are nice maybe for people whose problem is drinking, but they're terrible for people who have been cursed with intelligence. I'm sorry, but that's the case. It is my experience, I want to say something now that may sound a little controversial, but I don't want to be controversial, but I believe to be true. I believe that the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have caused more people to die drunk than anything I know. Because they keep people out of AA. And they really shouldn't. And they kept me out of AA, but they really shouldn't. But because we read into them something that is not there. And I think of all the 12 steps, if you can accept the first three steps, you are home free. I still use the first three steps. They are the most valuable things in my life in the sense as the trampoline that I bounce on when I'm going down. They move me back up. And I have to go back to my early days. I'm going to give you a long harangue on each of the steps. I'll talk just a little bit about the first three steps. Then we'll close this off. But the first step seems rather complex. We admit we're powerless over alcohol, and therefore our lives have become unmanageable. And that's not my problem, really. My problem is all these feelings that come when I'm sober. And my sponsor, who is a strong, intelligent, but very straightforward man, used to tell me things like, for Christ's sake, why don't you just read the black part? Doesn't say that. And he had to point out to me a little thing that can be a good writer. He had to point out to me. It doesn't say all the things. It doesn't ask you to get sober. It doesn't ask you to admit that your problems are caused by alcohol. It doesn't ask you any of this. We want you to admit, have you had some trouble drinking? Yes, I have. But it's not my fault. No mea culpa is my motto. He said, that's all it asks you to do. You had some problem drinking. If you didn't, you wouldn't be here. Hardly anybody gets up in the morning, after controlling their drinking well, walks into the rose garden and says, God, what a lovely morning. Think I'll join AA. We all come here because drinking is getting to be a pain in the ass, is what it's getting to be. You don't have to admit you're the world's worst drunk. You have to admit anything. Have you had some trouble drinking? Yes, I have. Okay. Then he said, kid, there's a dash there. It doesn't say, and therefore. There's a dash. And the English language, dash, means end of thought, beginning of new thought. Have you had some problems when you weren't drinking? Yes, I certainly have. That's all we were asking you to admit. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash, end of thought, that our lives had become unmanageable. You have to admit you're having some problems when you're drinking, and you got to admit you're having some kind of a problem when you're not drinking. And if either one of them weren't that way, you wouldn't be here. If you could still handle your drinking, you'd be handling your drinking. If you could still handle your sobriety, you'd be handling your sobriety. You only come here when you gave up. You can't handle your drinking, you can't handle your sobriety. Is that clear? Yes, it is. I never had anybody explain that to me before. But that's what it says. People who read things on this step, whatever they read into it, you just try the black parts. Just try the black parts. When all else fails, try the black part. I've had some problems drinking, I got some problems sober, and it's not my fault. Okay, good. The second step gets a little bit spookier. Because then you got to return to God. And I remember sitting in a meeting years and years ago and explaining carefully at the second step meeting, if you've been a Norwegian Lutheran and you've broken all 10 commandments the way I have done, you cannot return to God. Incidentally, I should say in passing, a couple years after that, I got thinking about that. I have not broken all the 10 commandments. I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. It's not a hell of a lot, but it's something. You know, it's a little spiritual pennant to fly. Second step, return to God. Now, and I had to explain this meaning. I cannot return to God, as far as I'm concerned, God ruins the concept of AA. I remember this old lady, either that meeting or some other meeting, came up to me after the meeting, said something like, oh, son, we hate to see you fight God. And I remember thinking to myself, it took all I could do to keep from saying, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." Now you can just hear me fight God on the old audio portion of your set. But my sponsor nailed me, as he always did sooner or later, somewhere along. I don't know. Couldn't all have been this concise, because it took me a long time to shape up. I'm expecting it any minute, is what I'm doing. I may not have had a happy childhood, but I've had a long one. Come on, Dick, join in the clapping. They're clapping for your sponsor, Dick. Come on. Jeez, that makes you feel good when you've given your life to help another man and he just sits there. I don't mind him looking at his watch, but he keeps going. You know, there's therapies now that talk about the inner child, trying to get the inner child out. I have an inner adult that's trying to make his moves.
Let me out.
Not now. Not now. I hope it's soon. I'm about to die of old age. But anyway, my sponsor had to point out to me, kid. He said, I feel like this can't return to God. He says, it doesn't say you return to God. Return to a power greater than myself. To that fool, these idiots, and it doesn't fool me, I'd be a bright mind. He says, it doesn't say that. It never says to return to anything. In AA, we never return to anything. We're coming out of sick perceptions of reality. It says you come to believe in something. You don't return. The only line in the whole book that talks about returning to anything is that some of the old guys used to want to return to normal living. But he said, a guy like you've never had any normal living, so forget it. And that's true. Not my fault. The depression, you know. I didn't know there'd been a depression, but when I found out in psychiatry, I could see what screwed me up all along. But you got to come to believe in something. Can't you believe in a God that's trying to help you? No, I cannot. I mean, I'm kind of a strong guy, you know. And the reason you have to believe that, if you're a Lutheran and you're a sinner, you better believe there's no God, because if there is, you've got no future ever. In fact, one time in Dallas, a bunch of guys and I were precious, cute. We were going to set up. We got caught. Somebody blew the whistle on us the last minute. We had this deal. We were going to put in a dial of prayer for atheists in the Dallas phone book. You'd call this number, and nobody ever answered. Just ring incessantly. I don't know why I have problems all my life. I seem to... But anyway, he says, can't you come to believe in... I said, no. He says, can't you believe in AA, for Christ's sake? The room is full of sober people. No, I cannot. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Yes, you are. Congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that, because he could not send me to hell. All he could do is give me a ration of crap every day. And he became a higher power. Let people out in the club, you say, oh, look at there. There's that sick bastard, got a sponsor for a higher power. But I will tell you this, if you are having difficulty with a higher power, the concept, I will tell you tonight, I would much rather see you believe in your sponsor that you believe in than to pretend to believe in a God you don't believe in. Because it gets to be 2 o'clock in the morning and you can't fool the dark. You better have something you really believe in. If it's just a guy to call up and say, I can't get through the night. Yes, you can, son. I sounded so good talking about all my prayers at the meeting tonight, but I didn't believe it, and now I want to kill myself. Believe in what you can believe in, I'll tell you. But I did things, and he had me take actions I didn't necessarily believe in. Little by little, he focused my pain. That's the value of sponsorship. The very same pain that makes sobriety untenable If I can bring myself to be desperate enough to let someone steer that pain, it will make me take actions I would never take ordinarily. It's the same thing coming in the plane today at O'Hare. The same engines, I was looking at the window, drove us 585 miles an hour all the way across the country. The exact same engines made us stop because they changed the direction of the thrust. I think that's what you do here. You take the pain and you change the direction of the thrust. The same thing that made me drink finally made me take an inventory when it was steered, desperation and fear. But I took actions. And eventually I came to believe in AA. And AA became my higher power. And I'm glad it did. A year or two after that, he got messed up with some other fringe organization. He got mad at AA because he didn't think they were up to his standards anymore. And he eventually got drunk and died. And people used to say to me, God, you're 2.5 years sober. Is this going to make you get drunk? I said, no. It proved exactly what he always told me. If you don't do these things, eventually you get drunk. And he stopped doing it, he got drunk. He proved everything he said was true. But I came to believe in a power greater than myself. Eventually, over a long period of time, I came to believe in a loving God. I remember sitting in the Norwegian Lutheran Church with my mother in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, years ago after I was sober a while, and being staggered by the thought, my God, the same God is in this room as is in my meeting in West Los Angeles. A God who loves me if I can get my own crap out of the way. But I wouldn't ask, if you're new, I wouldn't ask you to come to believe that. Come to believe in something. That's all it says. Came to believe that a power greater than myself, you have to admit, even see how it's going to happen. Can what? Can restore you to sanity. Now, what the hell does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. It means what it says. Now, what is sanity is really a terribly difficult thing to define. You could read 10 textbooks on mental illness, and sanity may have a different definition in either one. But oddly enough, insanity is relatively easy to define. In psychosis, that is when the human brain, human mind, in a sense, very simplified, under a great deal of conflict, will set up an artificial perception of reality to change the conflict. In other words, it'll make things look different. The same things look different. And in some people, it's just like a rifle. Some people, it's all the whole world. They have to go to hospital to never get out. This is called psychosis. Some people have just little bits of psychosis, and sometimes when the right situations are up, it happens, and then it doesn't happen again. But psychosis is insanity. I used to think sanity was when you laughed and were happy all the time. But then I had to remember, the only guy I've ever known who was laughed and happy all the time had the next bed to me in the electric shock ward in Texas, you know. Fred, how are you doing this morning, Fred? Oh, I'm just fine. That's the only machine you're never going to get out of there. He just stopped smiling. So what is insanity? Is psychosis when the brain must set up an artificial perception of reality. And despite what anybody tells you, we talk about how crazy and I got well, crazy got well. When you become truly psychotic, that's it. Cases of psychosis becoming normal again are so rare as to be unbelievable. We think of pain and emotional conflict as neurosis. Psychosis is when it gets so bad, your brain can't take it. We get very neurotic and upset and feeling better again. We change perception. But here's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming true psychotics is all close to invisible. Now you say, well, how can that be? They list alcoholism as the second greatest cause of insanity. And it is. And is rapidly overtaking the first cause, which is syphilis. Well, they can find answers to syphilis. Not much. But that is not psychosis. Alcoholic insanity is when your brain cells have been destroyed by continual drying out from alcohol. I don't want to get off into this, but it's kind of a funny thing. A wet brain is really a dry brain. The same when you drink a lot, alcohol is a dehydrating agent. That's when you get up in the morning after being drunk. You're so thirsty because it's dried out a lot of cells in you. You got to pour fluids in. And goes through your body, eventually dries out or desiccates brain cells. You have millions of them, but eventually it's enough so that you can't function. Alcoholic insanity is something that I would dare say you may never see a case of it in your life. I see them all the time. I wish I didn't. Alcoholic insanity, they're not sitting in meetings talking crazy. They're not acting funny on the street corner. Alcoholic insanity people sit on a bed or on a chair on a ward, and people come along 3 times a day and feed them and change their diapers and put them to bed and get them up and feed them and change their diapers, and they can never get better because brain cells do not regenerate. Brain and liver cells don't regenerate. So these people, it's like, as I say, the terminal stages of syphilis, except for one thing. Syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholism, you can sit like that for 40 years. And at first, your loved ones come down and look at you, and you look at them vacantly, and after a while, they come down once in a while, and after a while, they don't want to come down at all. After a while, you're forgotten by the family as you sit on your bed and gaze at the wall. That's what alcoholic insanity is, not psychosis. Why don't alcoholics become psychotic? And that gets down to the very reason we have discovered why there's alcoholism. Because alcohol has an unnatural effect on 5 or 6% of people who drink alcohol. And the people who get the unnatural effect don't know it's an unnatural effect, and the people around them don't know that those people are getting a different effect than I'm getting. What is this unnatural effect? Staying drunk all the time? Nah, that's podium talk. Makes you act crazy? Some people it does, some people it doesn't. I see alcoholics die who have never acted crazy once. They get so catatonic they can't move. The unnatural effect of alcohol on alcoholics that makes it an almost irreversible procedure is this. It must have the power to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must take the same things and make them look different. People have different ways of describing it. It must take me from Kansas and put me into a Technicolor place. It makes it Oz. It must change. It must take my feelings of inadequacy and get rid of them. Takes a person like me who never feels good enough and makes me feel like I'm more than enough for a while. It takes a person like me who lives with fear and makes me temporarily fearless. It takes a person like me who lives with feelings of rejection and hurt feelings, and I just feel all together. And it's just great. And I always assumed other people all got the same feeling, and if they didn't drink, it's because they didn't feel that way. And it wasn't until I was sober for some time I realized that what it is, the reason they don't drink, because it doesn't do that for them. For them, it goes blah, 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 and eventually makes them dizzy and eventually drunk. To me, it makes me whole, and I want some more. But I think a case can be made very easily. Alcoholics never become psychotic, because when the brain gets under enough pressure, I can literally induce temporary psychosis. I can change reality. Boom. And if it does that for you, you'll never find anything better. No narcotic, no anything better. And so, now alcohol is starting to kill me. And sobriety is unbearable. So I guess the second step says, you don't have to believe it, you don't have to understand it, you just have to accept the concept. Somehow or other, I've got to try to come to believe that some power greater than myself that I can't understand is going to restore me to being able to live in reality without having to induce psychosis to stand it. Came to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me. You don't have to understand how it's going to happen. That's the whole point about it. You just have to take it on spec. And that isn't very complex at all. And the third step is a little spookier because it says, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And that's a little kind of religious. Except if you look at it in the sense that what you're saying is this. I have been screwed up, drunk, and sober. Somehow there's a power here in this AA crap that's going to make me better. And the third step says, I'm going to try it whether I believe it or not. And that's what it all boils down to. Turning your will in your life, they could argue about that, like, debate about that, like what that really means, like how many angels on the head of a pin. It means that you're going to surrender your intellectual judgment and do what is suggested to you. You are going to turn over your will and your life to the care of God as you understand Him, a higher power, the power of this group, the power of your sponsor, the power of recovery. And if you can do that, eventually you'll find it much easier to write an inventory and to read that inventory and to make a decision to ask God to remove your defects of character. And it becomes easier to make amends to people that you've hated all your life and make that great discovery. Once I've made an amend to that guy that I hate, I will never hate him again. And on all kinds of things. I'll never hate myself so much. And continue to take inventories and eventually get to a stage. It's not just a coincidence they put the meditation stage way down after you've done a lot of other things. Because you got to get some stability in your life and some self-worth before you... That's why these esoteric mind and emotional and religious games sometimes kill people like us. Because we use this as a replacement for getting self-worth instead of as a net result of getting self-worth. And as a result of that, someday you will learn the greatest gift of all. The gift you have been given to talk to other alcoholics and be able to do something for them that no doctor or psychiatrist can ever do. And they will sometimes they won't even understand it. But Alcoholics Anonymous is, when you stop and think about it, I'll tell you, in 1990, I was honored to be able to ask to talk at the International Convention in Seattle. They asked me to talk on primary purpose of AA, and I was talking there, and I stumbled on a phrase when I was trying to explain something. I thought about it later. I couldn't have described this if it took me 10 years to write. I couldn't put it better. It just came to me in just a blurt. Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the same as it is tonight in Harvey, Illinois, as it was June 10th in Akron, Ohio, with this doctor getting sober and this stockbroker, or all the times in between. It is not the book. It is not the meetings. It is not love. It is not kindness. It is not service structure. It is not unity. Because AA was there before any of these things existed. All these things are important things, but they're backdrops. What Alcoholics Anonymous is, it is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And that's what AA is all about. So, and if you and I understand that, we can help people reduce their differences more than any doctor or psychiatrist they meet. But you got to give it all you got. But that's what I say. The trampoline here, all these steps are wonderful. We can talk about them forever. But the trampoline are the first three steps. Because sometimes today, I get carried away. Sometimes I get in pain from trying to juggle too many balls. Sometimes I get carried away with my own magnificence. I start believing this crap that some guy said, you saved my life. And I think, yes, I did, didn't I? Yeah. You're goddamn lucky I came along, you little puke. So. Now, when you get out of sorts, because we were talking about it again before the meeting, nobody ever rises above human being here. We always have, we're going to have weaknesses and faults. But you can always go back and wonder why you're here. Why should I keep doing this? I've been sober, God, in a couple of months, it'll be 35 years. I've given him my life. I've done a lot. Why do I have to keep doing it? Tell you what. Because I'm no longer able to drink. And of myself, sobriety becomes untenable. And I came to believe that there was some power here amongst you, wherever it might be, that would restore me to being able to live without having to induce psychosis to stand it. And if I continue to do these things, to turn over at least as much as I can of my life to the care of this power, I will continue to feel better. I want to close by saying I understand what they mean when they say action is the magic word. Action is what does it. Not thinking, not philosophy. None, all this is very nice if you like to do it. People, I sit sometimes in meetings and hear people talk about God's will and what God's will really is. I don't know anybody that knows God's will. I haven't seen anybody who's got the signed agreement saying that they're God's representative on earth. You know, there's a fellow who wrote a book named The Seven Story Mountain, Thomas Merton, one of the great minds of our century. He wanted to find God's will. And he signed himself into the Gethsemane Monastery in Kentucky. And for 13 years, he sat in a cell and contemplated God's will. After 13 years, he came out and he wrote a prayer that I have on my wall. And it's one of the great prayers of all time. It says, "Dear God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead. Prepared to please you. I hope I never persist in anything apart from that desire. I know if I do this, you'll never leave me to face my problems all alone." I got to keep thinking. But Thomas Merton, a great, brilliant writer, brilliant man, summa cum laude from Columbia, could not figure out God's will after 13 years of silent meditation. There's not much chance you and I are going to get it by midnight tonight. But we have to. With that group, and I found the group primarily because I kept getting defeated for a secretary in other groups. They didn't understand me. But I started this group 35 years ago this year, 30 years ago this week, this year, and about eight people at the first meeting. There was a speaker meeting, then 12 people, then 20 people. And then I offended some people in my announcements. We went back to about 10 people. And after about a year, we had about 60 people. And they were really a nice group. They were coming along, enthusiastic. But there's like an emerging African country. They weren't quite ready for self-government. I could see that. I thought maybe we should have an election. Probably not. That would just screw things up. So I sacrificed myself and became secretary another year. And then in 2 years, we were up to about 120, 190 or 100, I guess maybe. And they're getting so close to that, you know, self-government, but they didn't have the spiritual values. So I sacrificed myself and became secretary again. And after about 2 months, one day I didn't like the speaker I'd chosen. I was in the kitchen reading 12 and 12 while he was talking. And I read across his line about how bleeding deacons hang on to things and they just won't turn them over. I thought, oh, Jesus. Then some of the guys in the group said, "We got to have the election." I said, "Am I not doing a good job?" Saying, "Oh, yes, that's not the point. But if people in other groups say, why don't you have an election, you know?" So at least we can say, "We elected him secretary. That's why he's secretary." "That's a good idea, son." So we had an election. And they swept me out of office unanimously. So for the last 28 years, I sit in that meeting every Wednesday night. That's my home group. I sponsored all the secretaries except one since then. But I sit there and I have a role as a founder and I give little signals during the meeting, you know. Nobody pays any attention, but it makes me feel good. And at the end of the meeting, I stand in the back and people bring up newcomers, you know, because I speak all over the world. And I'm the founder of the group and I've been sober a long time, and This is Clancy. He founded the group, and he speaks all over the world. "Hello there. Nice to have you with us. I hope you'll find here what we found. Good luck." And I do a wonderful... I just sometimes... tears of self-admiration fill my eyes. And once in a while, they'll bring up... somebody will bring up... some puke will come up to me who does know who I am. I said, "Hey, buddy, Can you give me a ride back over to the VA psycho ward? And the nice thing about AA, my sponsor taught me this in 1958, and it's just true tonight. You can think whatever you want. I could look him right in his ugly little eyes, pig-like little eyes, and think at him. What? Give you a ride to the psycho ward? You belong in the psycho ward, for Christ's sake. There are 1,100 people here who need action desperately. There's one who has been drained dry for over a third of a century, for Christ's sake. Give me a break. I am not just some guy standing here looking good. I'm Clancy I from up in the sky, world famous speaker, for Christ's sake. I am something. And I can look up at his pig little eyes and just give him that. As long as I say, okay. And the strange part about AA is this, is after I dropped this little puke off of the psych ward, and I'm driving home, my mind says, oh, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? And that's not because I'm wonderful or good. I've learned that the actions of AA will make me better than I am. And I got those actions through the 12 steps. And I hope I keep to remember to put them into my life as imperfectly as I do it as an imperfect human being. So I can be with you and you can be with me as we, they say in the book, trudge the road of happy destiny, this fellowship of the Spirit, and live with some degree of dignity in a world that used to baffle and destroy us. I hope we will never forget that lesson. Thank you.